There have been so many changes in the last generation that we have to study some of the new situations that have arisen in order to find keys to the peculiar tensions and stress of the present day. I think one thing we can almost all remember, and that is that we were brought up in a smaller world than we live in today. We were brought up in a world in which the private problems of the citizen occupied the greater part of his time and attention. He was neither equipped nor inclined to take on responsibilities that were utterly beyond him. He recognized certain limitations and had a modesty about his own knowledge, which has almost completely disappeared. He realized that all of the larger responsibilities of society had to be in the keeping of experts and specialists in these areas, and he was simply not qualified to pass judgment. Today, you can hardly find anyone who does not regard himself as lacking qualification to pass judgment on everything, everyone, and every situation that arises. We have a certain sense of moral obligation to have opinions. Whether we are informed is not important. We have come to the conclusion that everyone's opinion is as good as everyone else's, and I guess in sober fact, that's about the truth of the matter. We have very little sense of the danger of allowing our world to become too big for us. This has happened. Our freeways are too fast for us. World news, world events are too complicated for us. The so-called progress of society is too much for us in a great many areas of living. We are struggling, we are hoping to make it. But in the meantime, we are whipping the nervous system almost more that our economy can sustain. Every neurologist, every specialist in fields of human health is aware that modern man is developing a collective fatigue mechanism. He is born tired. And people who are tired become very easily irritable. And from fatigue arises faulty judgment. And from the mistakes we make, naturally, must arise powerful defense mechanisms, to say nothing of the waste of energy and time required to correct these mistakes. So today, we are a very much fatigued people. We are expected to be informed on almost every subject. We also have a feeling that comes with fatigue of irritability. We are unable to carry the small problems of life with gentility. We cannot have a debate without it becoming an unpleasant scene. We cannot discuss any subject without making enemies. We can pass no opinion without someone rising up in righteous indignation to declare that they object. There seems to be no reason for much of this. There seems to be only an exhaustion, an irritability. And out of this irritability, there arises the causes of feud and of very serious national and international problems. So I think we must, this evening, consider something of a philosophy of man's adjustment with his world. The first question that arises, I think, is, can anybody, except a moron, adjust pleasantly to existing conditions? Yes, I think that probably any individual can improve his adjustment through a very quiet analysis of himself. I do believe that it is possible for the individual to transcend pressures of almost any degree that are exerted against him. I say it is possible, although very few of us will ever be able to do it in a big way. Actually, man has the power within himself to protect himself against any circumstance exterior to himself. And if he had the wisdom, if he had the skill, the foresight, he could eliminate from his life most of the disasters through which he was passed. That such a possibility exists would be well within the spirit of Zen. Also, Zen would affirm definitely that the individual can achieve adjustment without becoming negative or unrealistic or without denying the experiences that go on around him. The individual can achieve the condition of being able to learn without pain. If he can achieve it, then it would seem that there are many inducements today for him to attain this desired goal. There are many inducements, and there always have been. But between the individual and this attainment, there lies a distance or an interval which he has consistently refused to cross from the very beginning of his experience as a human being. One of the things that we can learn from going back over history is that the average person has never been able to reach a point in his development in which he could rise above the pressures of his own disposition. He has never been able to be right for the sake of being right. He has never been able to overcome the combativeness and the belligerence of his own nature. And after thousands of years of war, we still have war. Because man, basically, is unable to experience the benefits of peace. There was an article in the paper a few days ago in an effort to defend the fact that war is inevitable, that there can never be a lasting peace so long as the world is populated by the kind of creatures that live in it now. This is faulty thinking, but it is certainly based upon a long record of man's attitudes. It seems that the more we do to enlighten the individual, the more he misuses his enlightenment. He uses the increased skills which he attains to lock himself still more desperately in conflict with his fellow men. And in the last 50 years, our knowledge has increased, our standards of education have increased, our economic levels of function have increased. Everything has increased except good nature. And that is one of the first victims of progress. We have lost kindliness in the process of attempting to attain skill. So Zen takes the ground that man himself is capable of determining how he will react to pressures outside of his own nature. He can control any pressure that does not control him. And no pressure can control him unless he permits it to. And the reason that most pressures control people is because secretly the people themselves rather like the pressures, or find in the pressures a way of gratifying some selfishness of their own. So we start now by trying to work through the formula of man's effort to escape pressure without isolating his own nature. Sort of insulation without isolation, perhaps. Actually, we can accept into our own nature anything that we wish to allow to pass the censorship of our thoughts and emotions. If our emotions say, yes, this is desirable, we acknowledge this desirable thing and accept it as an experience of consciousness. The same is true of the mind. If, therefore, we are naturally selfish, we accept selfish pressures from outside. If we are naturally emotional, ambitious, we allow ourselves to become the victims of the ambition pressures around us. But we have to sell out first. The individual cannot be contaminated or injured by a pressure which he will not accept. Now, in addition to this problem of pressures which he will or will not accept, we have to also realize that pressure is not necessarily the intensity of the outside circumstance. Pressure is the intensity of man's reaction to it. Now, we can say, for example, that a freeway exerts a terrible pressure upon the individual. Actually, however, it probably does not exert this pressure. The pressure arises within the individual. It arises because he himself is inadequate. His heart begins to pound because he is afraid of situations. He realizes that in this tremendously intense situation, many persons not too skillful are at the wheels of deadly weapons. He is frightened, he is worried, and he becomes tense and becomes himself a very dangerous element in the pattern. I think we would find that under hypnosis, this same individual would be able to drive the freeway with full alertness of his sensory perceptions and no marked increase of his nervous reflexes or his cardiac rate. We would find that this tension arises from a series of psychochemical factors within himself. Also, if this person, for any reason or other, felt that at a certain time his reflexes were not adequate, he can always get off of the freeway. He does not have to fight the thing to the end as we seem to feel it necessary to struggle against pressures until they destroy us. Pressures, therefore, represent the actions of other people. And there's an interesting possibility to assume that our reaction to pressure is largely karmic. We accept the pressures we deserve, just as we accept everything else in life that comes in because of our own constitution. Therefore, the way in which we react to the intensities of civilization, of world events, and the degree to which we permit these things to trouble and destroy us, this whole chemistry is karmic. It is the weakness, inadequacy, inability in ourselves that causes us to achieve only confusion as a result of pressure. Now, we can say definitely that in order to escape this pressureful circumstance, More is required merely than to lock the individual attitude against pressure. The person who says to himself, I want to live a less pressureful existence, must set the law of karma operating in the direction which he requires. In order to experience less pressure, he must cause less pressure. In order to be free from pressure around him, he must relieve himself of the pressure within him. He must cause adjustment rather than confusion. He must cause an harmonious relationship between himself and life rather than the intense relationship which he now experiences. How can he do this? In the first place, he can begin to investigate his own psychic integration. He can realize that he is tired. But why is he tired? Is he actually tired because of the exhaustion of his employment? Is he really fatigued because of the newspaper and the television? Is he actually worn out by the uncertainties of international relationships? Usually these so-called outside causes are excuses rather than reasons. He is actually inwardly fatigued for lack of the integration of his own nature. He is inwardly fatigued because he has not brought his own appetites and instincts within the control of common sense. For example, one reason why he may be terribly nervous and tense is debt. And why is he in debt? Because he has spent more than he has. Also, he can say emergencies forced him to do this. If emergencies forced him to do this, then it's almost certain that he was not prepared for emergencies. Now, it's hard to be prepared for emergencies today, but it is still harder when you live beyond your means every day. The individual is in trouble, is in tension, and is under stress very often simply because he has lived poorly, because he is not doing the things that need doing, and he is not following common sense procedures himself. Another great cause of pressure and tension, of course, is personality conflict. And the person should ask himself occasionally, why am I under such constant personality stress? Is it because I am trying to defend the fact that I am always right, when the obvious proof is so much against me that I'm nearly a nervous wreck trying to maintain my end of the argument? Actually, the individual who is unable to admit defeat in these things, who is struggling desperately to preserve an image, both for himself and for others, which he cannot maintain, is naturally under tremendous pressure. If this same person, finding themselves in an embarrassing situation due to their own mistakes, would simply smile and say, well, I guess I was wrong, there's no tension building. But if the person refuses to admit this, he most certainly will try to shift the blame. When he does that, he enrages other people. And very soon, a great deal of tension arises, and this is what happens between nations and causes war. So wherever the individual is under tension because he is living a code of pretensions, one way is to reduce tension is to stop pretending. To simply acknowledge that we cannot, any of us, always be right. Nature has given us two tremendous escape mechanisms to help us to work with tension. One is laughter and the other is tears. Both of these will break tension. Now, tears are usually a rather unhappy way of doing it, because the individual is either very sorry for something or very sorry for himself by the time tears set in. But laughter is always a happy way of breaking tension. And the fastest and best way we know of breaking a tense situation is to be able to laugh at our own mistakes. laugh at ourselves rather than other people. When we no longer take ourselves with such desperate seriousness, we do not have to defend an indefensible situation. So we go on down examining one little pattern after another to find out why these tensions close in on us. I know people who have almost died of freewayitis in the last few years. They are fighting freeways morning and night. They are striving desperately to get somewhere and perhaps risking their lives. I've asked these individuals why it wouldn't be better for them to start 10 minutes earlier or 15 minutes earlier and perhaps go on a less speedy road, or else at least not be in such a desperate rush to get somewhere. Most of the individuals simply can't even conceive starting a little sooner. This is beyond them. If they start a little sooner, they'll have to eat breakfast a little sooner. They'll have to get up 5 minutes sooner, or 10 minutes. And it all adds up to an impossible situation. The only answer is to get behind the wheel and try the best you can to get there on time when you start late. If you can do that, you're a success. And people feel this is necessary. The old story, of course, on this that I think is a classic is when Wang Chung, the great Chinese statesman, rode on an express train with President Ulysses S. Grant when the train was making a record-breaking run between Washington and Chicago. Grant was walking around with the old-fashioned gold watch in his hand, watching the record being broken. And the Chinese statesman was sitting blandly watching the American president. Suddenly, Grant snapped the watch shut, turned to the Chinese and said, "Earl Lee, we've done it. We've made this trip in 10 minutes less than it was ever made before." The old Chinaman smiled and said, "Yes, Mr. President, now what do we do with the 10 minutes? No one had any answer for that one. Yet we are killing ourselves for lack of that answer every day right here in this generation. We are allowing our bodies and our minds and our emotions to take an unnecessary beating simply for reasons of this kind. Another beating that we are taking and giving is alcohol. The desperate effort to stimulate or hold up or relax or do something causes the individual to endanger his health and ultimately become the victim of more serious and desperate situations simply because he feels he must find some way of letting down without changing his habits. His solution is, instead of changing the bad habits that he already has, add another one to them. This will really accomplish something. So more health is undermined. More energy is torn down. Another problem that is hurting most people at the moment very much is this desperate effort for complete freedom of life. The individual wishes to do only exactly what he wants to do, when he wants to do it. And any interference becomes a desperate cause of anxiety, of resentment, frustration, and neurotic pressure. Now, it happens in this world that no one can ever do exactly what they want to do all the time, or even most of the time. We have moments of reward in which our little hopes and little wishes are gratified. But society consists of persons, all of whom must sacrifice something of their own privileges in order to create a cultural civilization. Civilization is built upon sacrifice. The sacrifice of rugged individualism to the common needs of society. And the individual who is unwilling to adjust, to give up anything of himself, the individual who would almost rather die than compliment another person, The individual who must always find something the matter with what other people do must live only to condemn, to criticize, to tear down. The individual who cannot permit any other person to have the privileges that that same individual claims for himself. This is a cause of tension, a cause of great frustration. We have people coming all the time who are totally defeated because they cannot do exactly what they please. Many of these people have assumed responsibilities. Now they resent those. The individual who bought the house now resents the fact that the monthly payments are of such size that he cannot take extravagant vacations somewhere else. He cannot spend the same money two or three times. And out of this situation, he actually goes into an emotional decline. He cannot follow through even the responsibilities to which he has committed his own life, his responsibilities to a family, his responsibilities to children, his responsibilities to his business and his job. These weigh heavily upon him, for every responsibility is a restriction upon total freedom. And the individual is struggling for total freedom. And what does he get out of total freedom? He gets the same mysterious thing that happens when the watch in a mainspring in a watch breaks. When there is no longer any resistance, when there is no longer anything which the spring is driving or pulling or pushing, the spring goes wild. And the individual goes wild. Instead of having freedom, he comes in the end to complete mental and emotional confusion. For our responsibilities are some of the most normalizing forces in our lives. One by one, we can consider all of the different things that people do to make life hard for themselves. And when we get the pattern all put together, we realize that it's hardly necessary for society itself to contribute anything. We can become nervous wrecks all by ourselves. But it is our tendency immediately to blame other conditions for our troubles. This evasion of personal self-analysis, this evasion of the willingness to sit down and think through our own mistakes, is one of the reasons why we do not see the operation of the law of karma as a just process in our own daily experience. Supposing we begin lowering these pressures by a distinct and definite determination of our own. Supposing we gradually work our way through careful planning into a condition or position in which we are dependent to a minimum degree only upon any circumstance outside of ourselves. That we are going to live so carefully, so wisely, so justly in our own relationships, that we are going to give other persons no just cause to be displeased with us. And we are going to give ourselves no unnecessary burdens or responsibilities out of foolishness, selfishness, or stupidity. Now, this doesn't mean that we can end all suffering, but we certainly can reduce it. We can reduce it to an endurable degree in which it will no longer bind our own attitudes. The confused person loses the orientation which provides him with a philosophy for living. The confused person doubts God, man, and the universe. And he has a tendency to assume that everyone else is as confused as he is. And if he cannot put the universe in order, he is inclined to believe it cannot be put in order. Thus, his own personal confusions lead to materialistic attitudes, atheisms, agnosticisms, and the like. And he comes more and more into a completely negative relationship with life. The first thing we can do, or should do, therefore, is to try to get ourselves out of this mysterious situation in which we have become involved. Through bad education, through false attitudes, through the stimulation of false appetites, through a completely inadequate general psychology of life, we simply have allowed ourselves to deteriorate. We have to correct this, because otherwise no amount of social reform can save us from ourselves. We can have everything that we can dream of today. We will still be in the same situation, because we'll start other dreams even more fantastic. Then comes into this by also pointing out the great difficulty of a person trying to work with the confused psychic nature within him. When we turn within ourselves and find a world of absolute nightmare, a fantasy that makes no sense, when we look inside of our own nature and find a mass of uncontrollable factors, we hardly have any concept of how to control them. We have the feeling that by the time we correct one fault, 10 others will have destroyed us. There seems to be no place to start. When we really become aware of our own mistakes, we suddenly discover how many faults we can and do possess. While we have denied any of them and all of them, we seem to be pretty highly advanced people. But when we face the facts, it's very disillusioning. Zen tells us that you cannot solve the problem, therefore, by going into yourself and trying desperately to reform each of the little separate impulses that is annoying you. You can keep this on forever, and you will still never reach integration. Because even if you browbeat some fault into submission, this does not mean that the fault, even though submissive, actually makes a valid contribution to integration or true cooperation. It is like a police state, a dictatorship. If the will dictates the control of the emotions and thoughts, you have no voluntary friendship between them. You have no cheerful cooperation, but only a sullen state of suspended rebellion. Zen then takes the attitude that this is not the way to do it. That if we have to fight with ourselves against every negative situation that arises, we will again be locked in conflict to the very end. Maybe a noble war, we may go down to a magnificent defeat, but we're not going to win. So Zen tells us that all of these faults exist and are annoying because they are sustained by mental or emotional energy. A very small group of basic energy attitudes supplies the energy for all kinds of selfish and perverse attitudes. All of these come, for instance, or nearly all of them come from self-will, which is one definite drive. And this drive manifests with an infinitude of minor types and kinds of self-willfulness. But behind all of it is selfishness and egotism and a certain willful perversity. And behind almost all of our faults, there are a few powerful, unreasonable, irrational intensities. Zen takes the attitude to reduce the energy allotment available to perpetuate attitudes. Zen takes the ground that the only way you can have energy is to save it. And to save energy, you have got to reduce the pressures by which your Western nature is likely to be upset. The Western person believes in pressure. He believes pressures make life. He believes that life is nothing more or less than a continuous manifestation of energy. The individual who keeps quiet is dead. We must keep right on to the very last, dashing toward something, even though it is only the open grave. The Zen thinker does not regard this visible, symbolic exertion of energy as a symbol of aliveness. He does not believe that we must sell ourselves the idea that we are healthy because we are always up to our neck in exhaustion. That we must be worriers, we must be profoundly concerned about things we know nothing of, in order to prove that we are mature, thoughtful people. All we really prove is that we're very ignorant people. Because our various formulas do not work, our solutions solve nothing, and our opinions are valueless to ourselves and others. So this cannot be the best answer. Suppose instead of this, we work for a quieting down of the entire inner life. That we work for a kind of retrospective mood, the mood of tranquility. That we gain this mood of tranquility by devoting a little of our time simply to unwinding, as Zen calls it, unknotting. That instead of sitting around tying knots in ourselves, we go to a quiet place somewhere and slowly and quietly untie the knots. That we realize that every one of the tension patterns that we build can be changed, can be modified, if we will simply, quietly reverse the processes within ourselves. It is perfectly possible to reverse these processes. So we have to find out how and learn a little of the experience of what happens when we do. For experience in all Eastern philosophy is the final selling agent. We become convinced it is true because it works and not because anyone says it does. Let us imagine then the process of unknotting for the individual. Realizing first of all, however, that you must be prepared for one psychic shock. Western man, when he begins to relax, thinks he is dying. He thinks he is falling apart completely. He does not believe that he will ever be able to crawl to the door. To him, relaxation is an anticipation of death. He suddenly discovers or feels as though he discovered that his heart had stopped. That everything was turning into a dull gray haze. That he was sick. So he dashes out and gets a drink or goes to his doctor for a shot or something. The mere fact that he is relaxing seems to him to be the most terrible symptom he ever faced. This shows you just how desperately ill man can get out of tension. He believes desperately that if he is not deeply agitated about something every moment, that he is losing his mind. How can anyone live in a mess like this without being a wreck? It is a moral duty to be a wreck, to show that you are sincerely concerned about the troubles of humanity. You do not realize that by being a wreck, you simply add to the troubles of humanity. That we don't get around to. So be prepared for that terrible moment when you are not sure whether you're on your way to heaven or to complete dissolution in space. In all probabilities, you are simply experiencing for the first time, perhaps in the entire mature length of your life, freedom from the desperate determination to be doing something. I had a grandmother who had that element really magnificently. She was always doing something. And she loved to sweep with an old Brussels carpet sweeper, which was all they had in her day. And she'd sweep the house from end to end. He turned through it like a whirlwind and looked around and saw nothing left to sweep. But she was a woman who wanted something to do. So she quietly opened the carpet sweeper, took out a handful of the dust, threw it back on the rug, and started over again. And she did this, of course, when apparently no one was watching. She didn't want to fool anyone else, but she was trying to fool herself. But this is very largely what people do, not quite so obviously, perhaps. But the individual who feels for a moment that he's not under tension is likely to jump in a car and drive somewhere. Or he's liable to turn on a television program which has a fine group of crime factors in it and go into another kind of nervous wreck watching it. To quiet down, to let down, is almost dangerous to him. Western man has never been able to relax. And out of his tensions, he's had one of the most tragic histories recorded in the entire story of our world's development. But let's imagine you are resolved. So you now begin to realize that this tension is not solutional of anything. If by being a nervous wreck you were helping somebody, it would be a tremendous incentive. Well, of course you are helping certain people, the physician and the undertaker, but generally he gets along fairly well anyway. There is no real good being done. You are not helping yourself. You're not getting anywhere. You're simply wearing out a machine that has a limited capacity. If you wear it out, you no longer enjoy its cooperative function. Start looking for the effortless activities of life. When effortless, I don't mean that they are complete suspension of all activity, but they are the suspension of all tension, quietude, gentleness of thinking, gentleness of action, the discovery gradually of quiet activities. Quiet activities that do not fight upon you as the ones that you have generally indulged in. Gradually sense within yourself a lowering of the combative egoism which most people depend on for vitality. Sit quietly and experience yourself as no longer desperately concerned with everything around you. Observe yourself as a detached being, a being in a state of quietude, as old Daruma wrapped up in his mantle in the Zen legend. Just quietly take a few minutes once in a while to start with and let go inside yourself, unwind yourself. Just feel beneath and behind these tensions. Now, one way of doing it is to be rather quiet. And then begin with a simple symbolism, the opening and closing of your eyes. Opening of the eye creates objectivity and relationship. The individual who opens his eyes becomes in that action a citizen of the universe of environment, things around him. When he closes his eyes, he no longer is a citizen of a universe of visual phenomena. Which is the universe most real to us? For sounds still endure. But we are more affected by sight than by sound. 50% of our attention will relax by the mere process of closing the eyes. In this sense of the word, just quietly close the eyes, and in so doing, you close symbolically your intimate association with the world of people, of things, of possessions. If your eyes are closed, you are making a statement of non-acceptance of phenomena. Now, this isn't a rejection. This is not a process of denying the reality of the world or of its problems. It is merely the affirming that by the control of your own senses, you can determine how much of the world you are going to let in at any time and how much you are going to keep out. Now, the purpose, of course, is not to keep out all of the world. The purpose, however, is to let in only what you can handle. Not to let in from the outside more than you can control by your own intelligence. If you let in too much, you then enter a state of confusion. Not to let in enough is to deprive yourself of the opportunities for growth through the understanding of phenomena. But our eyes are intended to provide us with experience. They are not intended to provide us with chaos. So we can control the amount of the outside world that we will permit to enter into our consciousness at any given time. And we must never let more in than we can administer. The symbolic action of closing the eyes brings with it usually a tremendous sense of relief. Meditation, of course, is a kind of waking sleeping. Meditation is a process of being consciously awake, but gradually separating yourself from the tremendous pressures of worldly attitudes. So meditation is possible only to the individual who is able to relax or reduce pressure tension, which he does at least symbolically by closing out this world of eternal turmoil in which he materially lives. Having determined to accept only what can be administered, what can be controlled, the individual then realizes that there are two courses open to him. One is that he must shut out a great deal, or the other possibility is that he must control more, that he must call upon his resources to enable him to control experiences without pressure. The Oriental has worked out some very interesting attitudes about these things. And I think that while it is in a world not too close to our primary interest, that we have to recognize that Zen was for centuries the philosophy of the Japanese soldier. The soldier was peculiarly close to Zen for the simple reason that he lived a completely precarious existence. In the Japanese cult, a soldier had no life of his own. He was bound utterly to his master, to the prince or noble whom he served. At any word, at any moment, at any time, he must be prepared to give his life without question. He must have no attachment, no possessions. He must have nothing which would cause him to swerve in his allegiance to his master. As a result of this particular type of thought, the soldier turned to Zen, which was a philosophy of immediacy, a philosophy in which courage, sufficiency, the ability to meet the moment with every bit of resource that we possess rests in the fact that we live in the moment. That in order to achieve this identity of immediacy, we must gradually shake loose all attitudes by means of which we would be bound to the preservation of our own lives. The Bible has a thought very much like this in it, by the way, about where it is stated that the man who tries to save his life shall lose it, but the one who shall lose his life in the service of truth shall have everlasting life. Now, this is the thought underneath the problem. In Zen, it is the doctrine of the individual who has relieved himself so completely of all attachments that he can at any moment make the necessary decision of that moment without tension. without regret, without fear, without anxiety, without compromise. It would be impossible for the samurai to say to himself, shall I weigh this emergency? Shall I decide whether it's more important to live or to die? This is not permitted of him. It is only permitted of him that he shall meet the emergency of the moment without any modification of attitude. Now, in the Zen for the non-military, in the philosophy of Zen, what we are working for in our escape from tension is immediacy of consciousness. If we can achieve immediacy, and at the same time have within ourselves a fair code of conduct, immediacy will mean that we will immediately perform that action which is best. This requires not only the courage of the samurai code, but it implies that we must know what is best. And nearly all religions and philosophies have worked with this problem, and they've all come to the final conclusion that the best is always that which is of the most complete good to the greatest number. Best is never gratification of self. Best is the clinging to principle, to the truth of the matter, to the fact of the matter, to the honor of the matter, to the integrity of the matter, and to the justice of the matter. Clinging to these factors immediately, without compromise, without anxiety, and without reservation. Tension is a tearing. It is the individual with divided allegiances. Wherever there is compromise within character, there is division of allegiance. Where the individual would like to follow a better course, but finds himself in the desperate situation of St. Paul, who says that whenever he would do good, evil was nigh unto him. Wherever the individual would say, yes, this is the honorable thing to do, but then pauses and says, but it will not be profitable. I will lose something by doing it. This would be the thing against which the samurai is warned. If it is the right thing to do, it must be done, regardless. And if it is done immediately, without evasion, without a long battle with self, it is then what might be termed an effortless effort. It is a complete action, free from the exhaustion of resource by tension. Intensity, as Zen would say, therefore, is the energy for direct action. Tension arises from the evasion of direct action. Tension arises from compromise of some kind, the delaying of things in the hope of some more fortunate solution. The effort to buy off a problem rather than to face it. A determination to hold on to some personal advantage, even though it interferes with the fulfillment of integrity. These compromises create division, discord, conflict. And where these come, the individual rapidly exhausts his energy resources. So we can say that in the Zen concept, direct action comes from a simple code and a complete courage to live it. This simple code we all have in some form. The Christian has it in the Sermon on the Mount. The Orthodox Jew has it in the Ten Commandments of Moses. The Muslim has it in the Code of Mohammed. The Roman had it in the Justinian Code. Codes of honor. Codes of character and principle. And the Greek, of course, also had it in his simple statement, death before dishonor. It was a simple matter. Socrates lived his code. He died without tension, even though he was actually executed. He had no sense of pressure. He lived according to what he believed, refused to compromise his character or his creed, and died at peace with himself, therefore free of tension. We are not usually required to die for our convictions anymore, but we are often required to live for them and by them if we wish to attain integration. Zen, by giving us this concept of the minimum of action and the minimum of energy, gives us the key to our own security. Supposing we are presented with a difficult situation in which there are tempting factors both ways. If we are not integrated, we will even regret any decision that we make. We will always wonder if we couldn't have gotten another nickel out of the deal some way. We will struggle and scheme to twist things around to make them a little more advantageous to ourselves. Here goes tremendous amounts of energy. But it requires very little energy in the presence of that which requires an affirmative answer to simply say yes and live by it. Or if it requires a negative answer, say no and live by it. Here you have used very little energy, but you have made a final statement. You have set a situation in a pattern by which it may only require maintenance. And having arrived at this, without regret, without remorse, without compromise, the yes or the no almost administers itself. It is when we begin to fail our own attitudes that they begin to fail us. If then in Zen we face the problems of tension, the first duty of Zen is to root out the tensions, find out where they are and why they are, and realize, as this ancient teaching points out, that the end of all confusion is direct decision, immediate decision, truthful decision, decision based upon all available judgment. Now, sometimes, undoubtedly, the decisions that we make honestly and truthfully will be unpleasant to other people. This is one of the inevitable complexities of life. Many persons will resent our honesty. Of course, they will equally resent our dishonesty, because individuals with such attitudes are going to resent anything and everything. But actually, one of the attitudes that arises with Zen is not only the simple fact of immediate decision, but the Zen thinker also begins to realize his relationships to other people. He realizes that he is not only required to be right, he is also required to be kind. And if he thinks things through, the right and the kind will be the same thing. If he is in trouble, it is largely because he has in the past compromised his standards of values. If he has done so, he must live with the consequences. But he must add no more of similar consequences. He must begin immediately to make the decisions that are the best for him and the best for other people. Those around us cannot benefit from our confusion, nor is there any use in our concealing our own attitudes behind it. Ultimately, the good for all concerned must be the honest fact of the matter.